You're a doctor in the house.
Doctor, doctor, give me the news. I got a bad case of loving you.
Doctor.
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 And doctor.
It's time for Advanced Medicine Monday with Dr. Rashid Batar.
I'm a doctor, not a bricklayer.
I'm a doctor, not a mechanic.
I'm a doctor, not a coal miner.
The doctor is in.
All right, checking in with Dr. Batar. We're about to dive headlong into advanced medicine here on the Robert Scott Bell Show. Dr. Batar, it is an auspicious day here. Our guy that makes us sound good each and every week, Super Don, turning half century today.
That's awesome to hear. And Super Don, I just was thinking as the music started with my intro when you made that. I guess it was like 8 years ago you made it. We've been doing the show almost about 9.5 years, but I think you made it about 8 years ago. It always puts a smile on my face because you tracked on my affinity for Star Trek. So I appreciate that, and happy birthday.
Super
Thank
done.
You. Thank you.
Yep. Tell Dr. Batar what your son got you for your birthday, because that's right in Dr. Batar's wheelhouse.
Well, yeah, it was really...
What? A tricorder?
A tricorder? No, I did not get a tricorder. No, he got me this print. I'd never seen this before. And what it is it's like a, I don't know, what would you say? It's like a collage of a bunch of the characters from the original Star Trek pilot, which had, if you remember, Christopher Pike and the original version of Spock, which changed when they rebooted it with William Shatner, but it's the print showing the Starship Enterprise and Christopher Pike and Spock and the green alien lady and the whole thing. It's very cool. Yeah.
Oh, wow. You need to take a snapshot of that and send that to me so I can see what it looks like.
I will. In fact, I'll do that right now.
Yeah, you can actually send it to him through Skype like you did me. I thought it was totally cool. But he queried me. He tested me on, like, who is that guy in the middle, right? As if I
Robert
didn't know.
Robert got it right off the bat.
As if
you
I'm
got
not
extra points.
A total nerd like you, Super Don, right? No, we're all here. Yeah. Anyway, we have a good time together, and you know, again, it's not only sounding good, but the information we get out to the world is good, and we enjoy doing it. And Dr. Batar, if you don't mind diving headlong into the Lyme disease, because that still is somewhat apparently controversial in the medical realm, in the medical world. A lot of allopathic physicians just kind of shake their heads and just kind of give up and send people away. That happens still today. They're like, yeah, no, I don't want to deal with Lyme disease. At first it was like, oh, that's all in your head, it's not real. But if it's real, the doctors aren't really equipped to handle what it really is.
Well, I think a lot of it has to do with that, the fact that the doctors that have been treating Lyme disease, their go-to has been chronic antibiotic usage, which then causes other problems. And although these doctors have found a better way of dealing with it, which is, you know, dealing with the obviously the infectious issue, it hasn't been widely accepted by the conventional side because it takes a lot. In fact, it creates many other problems. So a lot of those doctors have been persecuted. Now, the thing is that we don't, in our clinic, in our clinics, we have never addressed Lyme disease directly. And the reason we have never addressed Lyme disease directly is because, Robert, I know you already know this, it's from the seven toxicity philosophy. I believe that if you try to treat Lyme with chronic antibiotic usage, besides killing your gut flora and annihilating the microbiome, you're going to create a repetitive cycle where it's almost like a dog chasing its tail, because you can maybe bring, theoretically, you can maybe bring the Lyme titers down, but you haven't addressed the reason why the person got the Lyme's disease in the first place, which is, if we recognize in the seven toxicity philosophy, the Lyme would fall into the third toxicity, which is opportunistic. Now, if it's an opportunistic, that means the Lyme's disease needed to have an opportunity, the spirochete needed to have an opportunity to set up house. Why doesn't it affect every human being if it's so virulent? Well, the reason is because certain people's immune systems have been suppressed from, one, heavy metals, or two, persistent organic pollutants, usually a combination of, and or, of course, nutritional deficiencies and stress and all these other things. That's the fifth toxicity, emotional, psychological, the seventh toxicity, spiritual. All these different toxicities will end up contributing to the immune system being suppressed. But usually the heavy metals, what we found, the heavy metals and persistent organic pollutants are first the issue that has to be addressed. And if it's not addressed, whatever you do with limes will come back again within a week, 2 weeks, a month, 2 months, whatever it is. I remember in Raleigh when they did the airing of the Lyme disease movie, the documentary, Dr. Jemsek, who was a friend of mine back then, Dr. Jemsek was featured in that movie because the medical board actually went after him and insurance companies came back and wanted reimbursement for all the payments that they put out. Blue Cross Blue Shield had wanted all the reimbursement for all the payments that they put out over the years for his patients. And, of course, I don't agree with the theory of just treating with chronic antibiotic usage, but I remember I went to that particular showing in Raleigh, they show a new movie for the first time, and they invite certain people to it. I don't remember what the term is, but anyway, they invited us to come. They invited me to come. I sat there and listened to the movie, and they had little private tables with groups of four or five people that were sitting there, and the woman that was sitting next to me was a nurse. I didn't know, and she made the comment about how doctors really suck and don't know what the hell they're doing and how she's been suffering from Lyme disease. She didn't know I was a doctor, and I'm agreeing with her the whole time, right? The whole 5-10 minutes before the movie started, then during the intro, then the whole movie. And I'm agreeing with everything she's saying. After the movie, they asked me to come up and say a few words. Well, they announced me as Dr. Bittard. You can imagine her face, her face like dropped. She's like, oh my God, I didn't know you were a doctor. I'm slamming doctors. I said, but I totally agree with you. Well, after I did my commentary, she talked to me and asked me about contacting our office. And she came to my office because her son, who was a star basketball player, had been diagnosed with Lyme and had been treated for the last 2.5 years and hadn't been even able to get out of bed, leave alone playing basketball anymore. In 2 months, now remember, he'd gone through 2.5-3 years worth of treatment. In 2 months, he was back on the basketball court. And all we did was we first identified his heavy metal load, started treating that, and dealt with the persistent organic pollutants. If you do this the right way, more often than not, you don't have to worry about the opportunistic because the body's own innate immune system will start to kick in and will address the issues at hand and take care of it. The problem is the immune system's been suppressed so that the Lyme disease can now basically run rampant. It's just like think of Candida, right? Candida, mm-hmm. If you take antibiotics, a woman will get a vaginal yeast infection a lot faster, and then it'll recur and recur and recur. It's the use of antibiotics. It's not the yeast that's causing the problem. It's because you killed off all the natural flora, so it's created a relative imbalance, and the ecology's been thrown off, which then allows that yeast to propagate unchecked.
So Dr. Bittard,
same type of thing. I think
it's once again going back to fundamentals. You know, it's okay, but it's foundational. And it's you know, why do I say doctors are having a problem with this? Because unless they go outside of their medical training, like you had to go back and learn what's real and right, going back to Antoine Béchamp and the law of the terrain, you have no earthly idea, and you could chase pathogens till the cows proverbially come home, right? It's not going to be the solution. You manage their disease until they die, and you create many other diseases along the way. Now, some have argued and gotten into controversies about Plum Island, and these things are like manufactured in labs in Fort Detrick. And, you know, there may be, some factual basis for some of these things, but it still doesn't discount the law of the terrain. You know, we talk about we talk about it with AIDS as well. Whether you believe or perceive HIV causes or has anything to do with it, it's somewhat irrelevant, even though the HIV test is a scam, that you'd have to say, well, how is it that these people die of a yeast infection? They have no immune system. Their immune system has been destroyed. How and why? Let's ask about their lifestyle, their diet, what medical interventions they've been on, what drugs have they been on. Just like you said about Lyme disease, the doctors that put you on chronic antibiotic use will eventually destroy your immune system completely. So wherever you started, you may feel a little bit better along the way, but it's a total disaster ultimately.
That's exactly right. It's applicable to something that we've been talking quite a bit about recently, which is the flu, right? The flu shot. It's the same concept. The law of the terrain is the golden rule. You have to understand how the creator, the master engineer, the ultimate engineer created his masterpiece, which is a biological system. I used to say the human body, but it's really not the human body because, you look at the cheetah, the fastest animal on the planet, or you look at the ant that can carry, 50 times as body, I don't know what it is, 50 times its weight, its own body weight, or whatever. It's a biological system that the ultimate engineer created. And if we look at how that system was created, which is the science of what we call physiology, then we can start to understand how many of these things work. And if we stay in line with the physiological principles, Robert, that's the key I think people should remember, that if we stay true to the principles of physiology, we will be far ahead of the game than we have been up to this point. very simply, we have to address what the body needs, give that to the body, and what the body shouldn't have in it, remove it, and then let the body's own system take over. What I have found that 95% of the time, I don't need to do anything more. If I do, then certain things we can then add to it. But for example, with dealing with the persistent organic pollutants, the second toxicity, we use ozone autohemotherapy, which, you know, we take blood out, and it's a natural way of getting rid of the persistent organic pollutants. We call them persistent organic pollutants because they persist in the body. The ozone actually breaks down the persistent organic pollutants and allows it to get out of the body based upon the work that was done in Germany and even at Baylor, but this is, again, intravenous. But what that also does, it annihilates all the bacteria, fungi, DNA addicts, all these other things. So it's actually taking care of that. It's like a multi-approach to dealing with pathogens. And many of these things that we deal with, many of these treatments, actually have a multifactorial aspect to it. But the principle that I want to push home here is if we address the toxicity issue, then many of these opportunistic infections no longer have the opportunity to set up house, and you're home free.
Right. And this is not me saying there's no basis for addressing an infectious agent. There are times we're intervening, and I would obviously much prefer utilizing silver and other botanicals that modulate immunity or have a direct impact than an antibiotic, although we would acknowledge in certain cases there may be legitimacy to using that form of chemotherapy, those antibiotics. But the reality is, unless you clear the terrain, get rid of the garbage in there, and this is a, you know, part and parcel of everything Dr. Bitar does, and, you know, a seminal book, The 9 Steps to Keep the Doctor, where he talked about the different toxicities in the book, you're chasing the proverbial microbial tail, and you'll never get out of that. Of course, if you're into just pure profit over genuine healing, perhaps the drug industry, the pharmaceutical industry, is happy that doctors don't go where you go with advanced medicine, Dr. Bitar.
Robert, I like that
microbial tail.
Microbial tail, right. I like that. That's really, that's actually more appropriate than a dog chasing his tail. But I think that the principles, again, are the most important thing to understand. And I think if doctors understand these principles and patients demand these principles, we'll be in a much better state of health.
All right, well said. Dr. Bitar is with us each and every Monday. We do advanced medicine together. Links are up in the show notes at robertscottbell.com. You can also visit advancedmedicine.com for loads of archives, as well as the IADFW. We'll mention that, as well as where Dr. Bitar is going to be coming up in January, and then the big one, Advanced Medicine Conference, Memorial Day weekend.
Listening to the Robert Scott Bell Show. The Robert Scott Bell Show. The Robert Scott Bell Show.
All right, I did a show last week, Dr. Bitar, with our buddy Chris Barr, not a doc. You met him, of course, when we were together at the Best Answer for Cancer in San Diego last year, or is it earlier this year? I can't remember. It's been so long. But there's a story here about one form of a neurological degradation issue known as Alzheimer's disease. Now, we've talked about mercury, aluminum, mineral issues, deficiencies, et cetera, a combination of the two. There's an article here about this saying that a mouse test confirms that sticky proteins associated with degenerative brain disease can be transferred. So they're now trying to argue that these sticky proteins are like a transmissible virus or bacteria. I think they're missing the mark on what really is the issue here with brain and neurological degradation diseases.
I completely 100% concur with you, Robert. They have missed the issue, and the issue comes down to, again, all pathology, I believe, comes down to one of two things, and it's usually a combination of both. One is lack of nutrition or lack of nutrient value in what the foods that we're consuming, and the second is toxicity. And, of course, my focus has always been on toxicity. I just recently, in the last 5 years, added the nutritional value to it because I see the difference. You know, it's like when you're running hill sprints, you don't understand what's the value of walking. But then when you've seen people or gotten to a position where you're reduced from being able to do the hill sprints for whatever reason, an injury, whatever, and you start walking, you see the rehabilitation aspect of it, you start realizing how important that walking is. Similar, the nutrition is important. I personally, for a long time, even though intuitively felt that nutrition was important, to me, it's like when you deal with pathology, nutrition, you're too late for the nutrition part, right? You gotta jump into the toxicity aspect. But the honest truth is you need both things, because if you have the toxicity in the body, you're going to deplete your nutrient value faster. If you have the nutrients on board, your body's going to be able to deal with the toxicity issues, but the nutrients alone will not be sufficient to get rid of the toxicity. So you have to address both things. Take out what the body doesn't need, the garbage, and put back what the body needs, the nutrients. Now, when you're talking about something like
I was just saying, I want to remind folks about the severity with which you've dealt with these things, like kids that were brought to you so mercury toxic from vaccines and other things, or even adults, that these are not typical exposures throughout history, right? These were rare happenstances that you'd find in the medical logs going, wow, this is very strange. And of course, we talked about chelation being discovered as a, you know, removal for lead kind of toxicity or poisoning, and then they found it also had other side benefits. So, you know, folks, we're not talking mild issues here. We're talking very severe issues.
Yeah, thank you, Robert, for pointing that out. You're absolutely right. You know, we're dealing with stage 4 cancer patients, autism, stroke patients that have been debilitated to the point they haven't walked in 5-6 years, bedridden. So we've had some pretty drastic cases, and many of those are on video. But when we're talking about this particular component with the sticky proteins and neurodegenerative disease and such, again, they're forgetting that what they're observing is the aftermath of the problem. What caused those sticky proteins or whatever else to happen? Again, coming back to my, you know, the person that I feel radically changed my direction in medicine, Dr. Bruce Lipton, when he talked about the expression of the genetic code. It's the expression of the genes that we have to look at, not the genetic code itself. And how does the genetic code get expressed? It gets expressed by programming a certain protein. So the genes will express a certain protein. But there's, remember, 20,000 genes and 100,000 different proteins that have been at least discovered. So if it was a gene to a protein, then that obviously doesn't work. The environmental trigger that triggers the gene to express the protein is what the issue is. And if the trigger, environmental trigger, is not a detrimental trigger, then the protein that we're talking about, the sticky protein, whatever it is not going to be expressed. It's expressed in response to an inappropriate trigger or a trigger that is unwanted. So toxicity, remember, is the environmental trigger that causes the gene to express in a certain way that then manifests whatever protein we're looking at. And when they're talking about these studies and they see these proteins, they're looking at the aftermath. They're not looking at the causation. And now you're going to create a drug to address that protein as opposed to getting rid of the toxicity. And that's why you're going to be in the proverbial micro, what is that again?
Microbiological tail of some kind, or, you know,
Robert, you come up with these little things, you know, so I got to think about
this. Write them down. And Dr. Bitar, I love your analogy. You talk about do fire engines cause fires? Because every time you're on the scene of a fire, you see a fire engine, right? How about like doctors, the way, maybe in a forensic way, they look at the aftermath of the fire and they see the wood is charred. And they would say, oh, wood char, that's what caused the fire, rather than saying, hey, maybe there were some electrical wiring issues, right? Kind of like the sticky proteins. They're manifesting in certain terrains and not others. Alteration of the terrain, the law of the terrain, still at play here when we talk about gene manifestation or gene expression. Folks, we've got a lot more healing to go on the Robert Scott Bell Show, a discussion of chronic fatigue syndrome and more coming up after this.
The Robert Scott Bell Show.
In all my years of radio, I've never seen anything like this.
The Robert Scott Bell Show. The Robert Scott Bell Show.
The Robert Scott Bell Show.
All right, ladies, if you still have your uterus intact, you'll remember that Dr. Bitar is appearing in Pasadena at the Yoga Expo coming up. Lord knows what date, because I don't have a uterus, so I don't remember. Dr. Bitar, when is that again?
That's January 5th.
Okay, January 5th. We did a story last hour. If you're just tuning in for Dr. Bitar, you didn't hear it. They were speculating that hysterectomy, uterus removal, results in memory deficit, and they actually did some interesting mouse models on that. But go back and listen. In the meantime, to wrap up this idea of transmissible Alzheimer's, Dr. Bitar. Again, it's not the first time we've addressed Alzheimer's in general, but now they're trying to claim, oh, you can catch it.
Well, Alzheimer's, it's interesting that the Alzheimer's Research Journal, I believe it's the Alzheimer's Journal or Alzheimer's Research Journal, there was a study published from Christchurch in New Zealand, and a friend of mine actually published it. And this was a number of years ago, and it was about the APOE allele. And it talked about, we, of course, look at the APOE, it's a cardiovascular marker, but we look at that in also passes of detoxification, especially important with how the mercury is eliminated. And so there's an ApoE2, 3, and a 4. And what was found was in the study that basically the if you have an ApoE4 from each parent, ApoE4, ApoE4, you have the highest non-ability, or you have the greatest inability to excrete mercury. And a 2-2, an ApoE2, ApoE2, and ApoE2 from both parents, you have the best chance of getting rid of mercury. And so the propensity of being able to get rid of mercury was directly correlated to your polymorphisms of ApoE. Well, then they looked at the incidence of Alzheimer's and looked at the people that had ApoE alleles for 4-4, and basically the conclusion was that if you had an ApoE 4-4, your chances of getting Alzheimer's was something in the 70th percentile after the age of 65, and it went exponentially up higher after that. Alzheimer's is all mercury toxicity. The difference between Alzheimer's and autism is only one thing, and that is chronic mercury exposure versus acute mercury exposure. Chronic mercury exposure over a lifetime in Alzheimer's versus a short period from the conception point till 3-4 years of age, the acute exposure to mercury. That's the only difference. How do I know that? How can I say that? How can I make such an irresponsible statement? It's very simple, because we've reversed both cases by addressing mercury. The Alzheimer's was inadvertently. We weren't even trying to do that. We were dealing with other issues, but they had mercury. We started removing the mercury, and as the mercury levels started coming down, their brain started coming back online. Again, coming back to the law of the train, the toxicity aspect. So Alzheimer's is not contagious. I just wanted to make sure that the viewers heard that. And Robert will go on with the next component.
Great. I'm glad you clarified it. We're going to get into chronic fatigue syndrome as it relates to the law of the terrain as well in a moment. We did have a question that was just submitted through Facebook on the Robert Scott Bell Show site, also to Dr. Bitar. And it was a question from Daniel, and he's talking about kidney failure. And he's been implementing different holistic protocols. He mentions vitamin D. He mentions cod liver oil. It wasn't working for him, basically. And then he's asking about something called Ezorb. I'm not sure what that is, but there is another reference. He mentioned the parathyroid. Again, we can't get into a lot of specific details of what this guy has done, this Daniel, but Dr. Bitar, in a general sense, maybe you can help understand what might be going on here.
Well, in a general sense, renal failure is something that we have seen more and more in the medical community because of the chronic use of non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs. And so there's a slow, insidious onslaught on the renal system, and basically the kidneys start going to this, what they call early onset renal failure, but it's really because the kidneys are concentrating all the garbage through the glomerular filtration apparatus, all the toxins that are coming out of the body when it breaks things down, you know, it's being filters the blood. So think of it as a filter that's being clogged up. And so they see that as early onset renal failure. So we can't go into all the details, like you said, Robert, but basically the parathyroid hormone and the calcitonin hormone, this is something important. And it's also in renal failure, one of the treatments that I use, and again, you have to know how to use it. It's the appropriate usage of some of these things. So EDTA chelation will actually reproduce this with people with early onset renal issues. And we've actually not only stop that from progressing, but actually reverse it, and the kidney functions came back to normal. Now, you have to do it in a very judicious manner, but it's interesting because the same treatment, chelation, which typically non-aware physicians will say, oh, it'll deplete your calcium, has actually been shown to increase bone mass density. So one of the things that people are told all the time about chelation is don't do chelation because it's going to reduce your calcium levels. So since he's talking about renal failure, and he's talking about calcitonin, he's talking about parathyroid hormone, he's talking about, basically, the relationship of this in renal failure, I'll just talk about that in a general physiological standpoint for right now. So there are two hormones in the body that regulate calcium levels in the blood. One is the parathyroid hormone, one is calcitonin. Parathyroid hormone's job is to, when parathyroid hormone is released, it's basically released in response to low levels of calcium, the calcitonin is released to take calcium and put it into the bones. The parathyroid is released to take calcium out of the bones and teeth and put it back into the blood because there's low level of calcium. So parathyroid hormone's job is to regulate calcium levels in the blood. If it's too low, parathyroid says, it's too low. I got to start pulling calcium from wherever I can. So it pulls it from the bones, from the teeth, from any other areas. And so it's pulling it from areas that we don't want to pull from. It's also pulling it from other areas too, where like old granular thrombus disease and tendonitis and ligament issues where there's chronic calcium buildup. It's pulling calcium from wherever it can. Of course, we don't want to be pulled from the bone and the teeth because that leads to osteopenia and osteoporosis. But the point is, it's pulling the calcium. Once that process starts, that process has to go for 20 to 21 days. It doesn't start and stop and start and stop. Once it's initiated, it starts for 20 to 21 days. So when that process starts and starts pulling calcium out of the bone and the teeth, there's another hormone called calcitonin. And calcitonin's job is to monitor the level of calcium in the bone and teeth. And as soon as it starts seeing that going down, it says, uh-oh, I got to put calcium back into the teeth and into the bone. So that process initiated. Once that process initiates, it goes for 120 days. It can't stop. Once it started, it can't stop. Now, what's interesting is that you have 21 days of calcium coming out of the bone and teeth, but you've got 120 days of calcium going back into the bone and teeth. So you have a net 99 to 100 days of calcium deposition from places where it shouldn't be back into the places where it should be. The reason I said where it shouldn't be, because it's pulling it out from the bone and teeth, but other areas where it shouldn't be, right? Calcium in the wrong areas of the body is pathognomonic. Cancer, we see a lot of calcification in cancer, for example. So we want to take calcium out of the places and put it out of all the different places and put it back where it's supposed to be in the sarcoplasmic reticulum, in the bone, and the teeth. And so this whole process of calcium net deposition has been shown in studies to to increase bone mass density by over 30% in 1 year with EDT chelation. And the side effect of this is to improve your renal function and your kidneys come back online. Once again, you have to have a doctor that's experienced in this and knows how to use this, tools. But this is a very common misconception that chelation would decrease calcium levels. It does not. And then, in fact, kidney failure, it does not. It actually improves it if used correctly.
So y'all can go back, rewind, and play back at 50% speed to catch about a half of what Dr. Bitar just said there. I'm just saying. Yeah, he knows he talks fast, but again, gets a lot out, and that's the nice thing. Super Don, can you? I know you can play, as he said, 1.5 speed fast. Can you play back on YouTube slower or not?
I think you can. I think there might be a way to do that.
Yeah. Slow down?
I think you can, actually. Well, I think
now people are now breathing a sigh of relief.
The good thing is that all these segments are being edited down into single bytes, so people can then zero in and find these segments that you and I do together just by doing a search under keywords. So people won't have to, they won't have to go through and hear too much of this. They can hear zero in on the part that they want to hear.
Right, and that'll be available through advancedmedicine.com, I'm sure.
Yes, that, and also through the YouTube channel.
Okay, excellent. Well, folks, we got to dive into chronic fatigue. Now, it's like all of these things have common elements. What? Well, the things you need, the things you don't need, right? The law of the terrain. Chronic fatigue, they're talking about an overactive immune system. Now, modern medicine, allopathic pharmaceutical medicine, says kill the immune system, destroy the immune system, chemotherapy, methotrexate, steroid hormones. These things are very devastating to the immune health. Also destroy the liver, which will impact negatively on the kidneys as well. So it worsens the terrain, even if it modulates or moderates a symptom temporarily. Here we talk about the chronic fatigue as it relates to the autoimmune or hyperimmune response until exhaustion, then you go subimmune, so to speak, and then what? It's really not being addressed correctly, and they always point to the Epstein-Barr virus, or typically, as if it's the true cause rather than the result of dysregulation, selenium deficiencies, toxicological burdens, things like that. It comes back to the same pattern once again.
Yeah, I agree with you, Robert. The law of the terrain is, super important. It's paramount. It's the most important thing. And as long as we adhere to that law and understand how important and how crucial it is to maintain a good state of health, we'll always be missing the target. So we have to start focusing on that part of it. And I think that more and more people are. That's one reason people eat organic foods and they try to abstain from things that they may recognize. I mean, some of the things that are obvious that are toxic, they may not always recognize everything as being toxic, but again, if we adhere to the law of the terrain, many of these issues that we're dealing with, many of these things that in medicine we deal with on a palliative level, we won't have to deal with at all because they'll be non-issues.
Dr. Bitar, I remember in my 20s when I had fatigue. Might have been called chronic fatigue because I was fatigued a lot. And then I met my mentor-to-be at the time was in his late 60s and had overcome deadly tuberculosis and more, who had more energy than me in my 20s. And I thought, well, there's something wrong with this picture. And they're talking about chronic fatigue following on hyperimmune response. In other words, they had previous months to years, like I had, of allergies, for instance, where you're overreacting until it's exhausted. And then, of course, it's convenient to blame a virus. Then what are they going to do? Antiviral drugs. What do they give for chronic fatigue syndrome? Sometimes they give antibiotics. I mean, there might be incidental or coincidental, if you will, microbial birds as well, pathogen birds that are bacterial, but they're not really the cause of the problem. They never were.
Right, and this is the thing that chronic fatigue and fibromyalgia have been kind of bundled together. And if you remember 10, 15 years ago or 20 years ago, they were considered to be a psychiatric issue. People
That's right.
treated for with depression. And now, mm-hmm. of course, they've got drugs for it. Well, guess what? I have never found a chronic fatigue or fibromyalgia patient ever that did not have a gut issue and mm-hmm. that did not have a heavy metal issue. They were
yep.
all, they were almost all of them were non-excretors. So when you do initial challenge, barely anything shows up. But heavy metals and gut issues were paramount. And if you looked at the hierarchy of which one came first, it's usually that heavy metals probably contributed to the gut dysbiosis.
You and got that course, right.
If you have heavy metals, you got to always look for persistent organic pollutants. But hormonal issues and chronic fatigue, fibromyalgia, you got to look at the gut. You got to look at the gut in everything, basically.
Yeah.
There's no pathology that, where you can say, oh, I don't need to look at the gut.
Yeah.
In cancer, I may not look at the gut right away just because of the time issue. But I always still have to look at it.
Sure.
And heavy metal.
By the way, I had four mercury amalgams in my youth, and I had them removed in my 20s, and that played a big role in reducing the ongoing chronic exposure to mercury. And then I did a lot of years of detoxification as well through homeopathy and other methods. Folks, we got a lot more healing to go. Only one more segment to do it in. How do you read the medical literature? What is it really saying? We're going to talk about that in a unique way after the break.
The revolution will be broadcast.
The Robert Scott Bell Show. The Robert Scott Bell Show.
Robert Scott Bell Show.
All right, links are up in the show notes at robertscottbell.com. You can also find archives through iTunes, Stitcher, TuneIn, SoundCloud, UK Health Radio, and, of course, our home and broadcast radio syndication, which is GCN, also simulcast on YouTube. When we're here to get together each week with Dr. Bitar, he'll also blast it out through, I think, Facebook Live. Is that right, Dr. Bitar? Are you still doing that?
Yes, I am.
Okay. And, of course, we've got the upcoming Advanced Medicine Conference, which will be Memorial Day weekend, the Saturday and Sunday of Memorial Day weekend, and that is in May, and that is in Pasadena, Los Angeles, California. And, folks, make your plans now to attend. We've got links to be able to get tickets. Super Don, you have those links still active, I'm sure.
Yes, I do.
And, once again, Super Don, happy birthday, my friend. You are just...
Happy birthday, Super Don.
Can't say enough nice things about you, even behind your back.
Now you're making me nervous.
Just to let you know. No, there's a big care package, and it's all wonderful things in there coming your way. Now,
Thank you.
By parachute, but apparently we don't even need parachutes. Right? This study is amazing. Super Don found this, Dr. Bitar. We've got to get to the bottom of this in pronto, because I don't want people jumping out of airplanes with no parachutes, because apparently this peer-reviewed medical literature says parachutes do not save the lives of people who jump from airplanes. What are we talking about here?
It's really an interesting little story, because when you read it, you think how absurd it is. But the researchers that did this, I suppose did it sarcastically, trying to show how we need to be critical when we're reviewing a study. And I think they said, 16 paragraphs down into the study, they saw that the people that they were assessing, the sample data that they're looking at, people were jumping 0.6 meters, which is about 2 feet, out of a plane that was grounded.
Parked on the ground, and they were jumping out
exactly.
with and without parachutes, and they said there was no difference in the outcome.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And it's interesting that they're trying to do this to demonstrate how studies can be used to put out any type of information, whatever predetermined agenda that the body that's putting out the study may have. But what I find very interesting here is this is an exact tactic used by the vaccine manufacturers. So if you look at it, it was the big Denmark study, and I don't remember all the details of it, but Boyd Haley dissected it so beautifully. And in this particular study, they showed that when they removed thimerosal from the vaccine, the incidence of autism increased, not decreased, but increased. Now, those of us that know how mercury works, and especially on thimerosal, which is ethyl mercury, which is 1,000 times more destructive than inorganic mercury, and inorganic mercury is considered to be the second most toxic substance known to man, according to the Environmental Protection Agency. So if you understand that, and you see thimerosal or ethyl mercury is 1,000 times more destructive than that, then how can you say by taking out thimerosal in the study group that it actually increased autism? Well, it's because of the age of the children that they were looking at, and mm-hmm. the institutionalized children, when they were comparing the years of data, they started changing the demographics that they were looking at. So they started looking at the institutionalized kids that had been already vaccine damaged and giving them the thimerosal-free vaccine, but the damage has already been done. And they were looking at the data to say, okay, look, we've taken out thimerosal vaccines, but look, if the incidence of autism is actually increasing. But what they did was the people in the earlier set of data, they were looking at all children. And then as they started going forward, they started looking at only older children that had already been vaccinated. They were only looking at the data that they wanted to show a higher rate of damage. So the end component of that they were looking at were all institutionalized children, all with severe autism. And so that subgroup was a much smaller subgroup than the original subgroup. But when you graphed it out, it looked like all mm-hmm. kids, the incidence of autism was increasing, but the data was not the same. You were comparing apples with, hubcaps. They wasn't,
right.
They weren't even fruits. It wasn't the same thing.
So Dr. Bitar, basically, what you're revealing clearly is that you alter the study design to create any outcome you want. And with so-called pro-vaccine science, it's science that's designed to fail to find a correlation or connection between vaccines and autism. And, of course, when they find it, they alter the data by fudging the numbers. Remember Dr. Brian Hooker talking about with the CDC whistleblower William Thompson. They just altered the numbers, the data, and came up with another conclusion. Well done.
Robert, just really quick, even in Simpsonwood, when they looked at the agenda with vaccines, they saw clearly that there was a correlation. They wanted to change that correlation, and when they talked to the epidemiologist, they said no matter how you change the data, manipulate the data, the correlation between vaccines and autism is clear.
Still there, yeah. By the way, don't jump out of an airplane that's actually flying without a parachute, just saying. On the ground, that's different. That's where the study, read the whole study, find out the design. Tell them what they need to know, Dr. Bitar, because we got to go.
The power to heal is unequivocally yours.
The Robert Scott Bell Show.